Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this is Scientology Month. Firstly, I just wanted to say that the audio in this episode does keep dipping in and out. I've edited what I could to fix it, but I do apologise if the levels are a bit strange in this episode. Also, a big, huge welcome to our newest patron, Becca. I am so excited to have you here, and I really hope you enjoy some of the exclusive content. And Becca has her own story to share, which will appear as a Patreon exclusive episode in the months to come, and I can't wait to chat at length. Now, some of you may know that Scientology is sometimes a dodgy topic to cover. Any insinuation of defamation or slander could end with someone's platform being forcibly taken over by the Church of Scientology after being taken through the courts. Now, I don't think there's a chance of that happening here, but I am aware of the dangers and consequences that often come with covering such movements. That being said, I am extremely grateful for all of the guests I've had the honour to speak with in preparation for this month. So, for the month of February, here is part one, an introduction to Scientology. So hello, listeners, and welcome to today's show. As some of you may know, we're covering Scientology across February, and today is going to be a little bit different because I have a guest on the show who is a very good friend of mine. Her name is Lou. Some of you may have heard about me talking about her before, because it was actually Lou's idea for me to start a podcast specifically on cults. When I said I wanted to start a podcast, and during lockdown and on my maternity leave, Lou said, well, maybe you should do cults because there's so many true crime podcasts and I'm like really interested about Scientology. And I was like, that's a really good idea. So I started the podcast, and when I arrived at Scientology, I thought it would be a really good idea to invite Lou onto the show so that she could tell me everything she has learned about Scientology. So today I am going to take a back seat and I'm going to hand it over to Lou and let her tell you everything she knows about Scientology. And then for the rest of the month, there's some interviews to hopefully fill in any gaps that we have left. So for any references, we've decided that if we forget to list them in the episode, we're going to list them in the episode description. So if anybody wants a list of the references, they'll be there. But without further ado, here is my friend Lou.
Oh, that was such a nice introduction, Casey. I feel like you've put me on a pedestal as a Scientology expert, but I think I'm probably much more like the listeners that are just really interested about different cults. And Scientology just fascinates me, and it has been for a really long time. So where would you like to start, Casey?
Ooh, well, I didn't do much research myself because I knew that you were going to be doing the bulk of the research. So most of what I know is either what I've stumbled across researching other movements and sects, or what I've been told in the interviews that I've done over the last couple of months in preparation for February. So I think we should just start at the beginning.
Yeah, shall I give you a little bit of L. Ron Hubbard history?
Yes.
Okay, so L. Ron Hubbard has quite a eclectic life before he gets to the point where he creates Scientology. So
right.
He's born in Nebraska, US, on March the 13th, 1911. And he grew up in Helena, Montana. So he moves around a lot over the beginning of his life. And actually, kind of throughout his life, it's a big theme. So I'm sure I'm going to miss some of the places that he lived because he lives everywhere. So his mom is a lady called Leodra May.
Right.
She was a trained teacher, but from what I could see, she didn't actually work as a teacher during his childhood. I think she worked as like an administrator. And his father, Harry Ross Hubbard, he was a former United States Navy officer. However, shortly after he is born, L. Ron Hubbard is born, his father then goes back into the Navy because it's World War I, and he's posted in Guam. So as and so this is kind of like the late 1920s, so Elwin Hubbard is probably quite a young boy, and he travels with his father on the ship, and they go to lots of different places in Asia and South Pacific. And what I find really interesting is that when Elwin Hubbard gets back from his trip, he kind of writes an article for the local newspaper telling everybody about all of the places that he's been.
So right.
That was in the Helena Daily Independent, and he kind of broke down the different places he'd been to and kind of gave an account of his travels. So it's kind of starting the roots of his writing, and maybe kind of that attention needing starting.
Right, okay, yeah.
So as a teenager, he goes to George Washington University, where he studied civil engineering. And Hubbard has this really big interest in planes and starts up a glider club, which he, of course, is elected the president of. So over the summer holidays, he organizes a trip to the Caribbean with the rest of the members of the club. However, so the aim of this trip was to find pirate strongholds and relics.
That sounds like my best day out. I want to go looking for pirate treasures and relics.
It's just so fascinating that was kind of his ambition, but unfortunately it was described that they had multiple misfortunes, which sounds so ominous. And they were running low on funds, so that trip doesn't go very well. So he returns back to the US, but then he doesn't return to university after that point. So in 1932, his dad says he needs to go, well, he volunteers him for the Red Cross in Puerto Rico. However, Hubbard travels over to Puerto Rico, but abandons his charity mission to find gold. So it's another theme that he's on the search for something there. His mission to find gold doesn't go very well, and he comes back to the US and meets his first wife, whose name is Margaret Polly Grubb, and they have two children together over the next 3 years.
Right.
So now he's back in the US, he's got his children, he's got his wife, and he begins to write novels. He writes pulp fiction novels, he writes fantasy, and he writes science fiction stories. So that's when his first time he started being published and writing a few articles for different newspapers.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but then, go on, ask him.
So yeah, so I was just going to say, I read somewhere that the L in L. Ron Hubbard stands for Lafayette, which I thought was quite interesting.
Really?
I think so. I think that was his granddad's name.
That's so great.
Lafayette. I was talking about True Blood in a couple of episodes ago, because I was speaking to somebody who was from Shreveport, and I was like, Shreveport's in True Blood, and Lafayette is my favorite character in True Blood, so all roads lead back to True Blood. And and then when you start speaking about him traveling with his father to all these places in the world, I imagine at that age, when he comes home and starts telling his local community where he's been and what he's seen, that must be like, he's been to all these exotic places that in the 1920s, like nobody was really getting to go and see. And he's like this kid who's traveling these, like, took these crazy, like, to these countries that are just so far away from.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I think that's the thing that's so interesting as well. And then the kind of themes of him traveling to Caribbean, and then him traveling later on, doing the mission where he goes to Puerto Rico. I mean, this is like the kind of 1920s, 30s. So it's not really, traveling is taking a long time. It's on ships. It's going quite, you know, far away. It's a very different world. And so I can imagine that had a massive impact on him and who he was, kind of having all of those different experiences. There's a great article I found where he literally, where they show his articles where he wrote for the newspaper, which I'll try and include, because he's kind of got different different highlights of what he did there.
Right, okay, yeah. Also, I don't know if it should be noted that all of L. Ron Hubbard's early life and stories should be taken with a pinch of salt, because there is a book called Barefaced Messiah that basically proves, well, disproves a lot of what L. Ron Hubbard says he was doing at certain ages. So I don't know if a lot of his stories have been embellished or over-exaggerated, or I'm not sure what the truth is, but there are suggestions that not everything he says he's done and seen is true.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, because there was something I read that he was in the Boy Scouts and he in Washington, and then he earned the rank of Eagle Scout in 1924, which was, so he was the youngest ever Eagle Scout. And then I read another article that then said, like, we don't keep records of how old Eagle Scouts were. So it's kind of that embellishment and kind of like, what is going on there, really?
Yeah. But then I suppose that comes with the territory of a charismatic leader. So,
well, yeah, definitely, and he's definitely that is him, isn't it? Because the fact that he manages to go from this place of writing novels and fantasy and science fiction, so very much not producing literature, well, research stuff, it's fiction, to then creating this these textbooks, which have become people's philosophies and ways that they live, is so interesting.
So he's married his first wife, they've got two children, and he's just started getting published, writing science fiction novels and writing for various newspapers.
Yeah, and then World War II starts.
Okay.
He then starts serving in the Navy.
Okay.
So he was an officer and he commanded two ships, but on the two ships, he was removed from command on both occasions.
Oh.
So, yeah. So the US Navy reported about him: this officer is not satisfactory for independent duty assignment.
Okay.
He is garrulous, which is a great word, and tries to give impressions of his importance. He also seems to think he has unusual ability in most lines. These characteristics indicate that he will require close supervision for the satisfactory performance of any intelligent duty. So things didn't go well in the Navy.
No, that sounds almost like suggestion of a psychiatric evaluation.
Well, that was very interesting that you kind of brought us there, because he leaves the Navy because he has various physical ailments, and the list is really extensive. So he then leaves the Navy. Well, I think he stays involved with the Navy because they pay him some kind of sick leave.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Retirement leave. But he is then based in California, and his first wife, Margaret Polly Grubb, and his two children live in Washington. So, and he makes the decision that he's going to stay in California. He's not going to go back to Washington where his family are.
Right.
He then has another marriage. So he is married to two women at the same time.
Okay. So Hubbard the bigamist.
I know. Yeah. So he marries Sarah, and it wasn't until a year after he marries this woman called Sarah that he tells his first wife that he's now married again.
Oh snap.
I know. So he's then writing, living on his kind of small disability allowance and borrowing money from his parents.
Poor woman with the children to find out her husband's gone and got not even remarried, just extra married again, twice married.
Yeah, so I mean, we'll come on to it later, but Sarah makes some allegations that are very concerning about the nature of Hubbard and Sarah's relationship. So living not that far and not having a long time in a relationship was kind of a good thing for Margaret and her children. I'm not sure there. So you were just talking about him like indicating some kind of psychological difficulties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So October 1947, Hubbard writes a letter requesting psychiatric treatment, kind of talking about how he himself feels like he needs psychiatric treatment.
Right.
He then starts writing a book of psychology, which is called Dianetics.
Right, yeah.
Dianetics, which I'm sure you've heard about from the other interviews, it's kind of mm-hmm. the foundations of these Scientology principles.
Yeah, it's almost like the Bible, like within Scientology as a religion.
Yeah,
the equivalent
it's building
of
block. It's that mm-hmm. it's that kind of like first rank of principles. So the principles of Dianetics is that your brain records every experience and event in a person's life, and these bad and painful experiences can be stored in your mind and later cause triggers of emotional and physical problems. So you're saying you have trauma from your past, and then it will manifest itself in, you know, a stomach ulcer or in feeling depressed because of you've got these things. There was the word for them, you used them earlier, which is
engrams, I think, is it?
That is it. So engrams, okay. So these kind of engrams are coming up. And he kind of said that through this process of auditing, which we'll move on to, is kind of a person can help a person clear themselves of these engrams because you're addressing them, and this would allow a person to become clear. And once a person was clear of all of their engrams, they would not be mentally or physically ill again.
Okay.
So interestingly, we've gone from this point where Hubbard is described to have psychiatric difficulties, loads of physical ailments, and then he kind of finds a philosophy that will say, I will never be ill again because I've reached these things.
Okay, that's definitely interesting. That's almost like it's strange. Like I once worked on a mental health unit with 10 over 60 year olds with schizophrenia, various types of schizophrenia, and sometime one of the women on the unit, she was born into wealth, and she was born, she must be like almost 90 now, and she was born into wealth, and her mother was very much the type of woman that took advantage of that lifestyle. She wore very beautiful dresses, listened to, you know, went to the opera, listened to very grand music, and kept, you know, upper class company, and lived in a huge, beautiful manor house. But she had this lady that I used to help care for. She had her out of wedlock, which at the time she was born was not something that was socially acceptable. So the mother was removed from the family home and cut off from all the allowances that she was given and the grandiose lifestyle that she was living. So her mother continued to bring her child up as if they were still living in those circumstances, even though they were only sort of in like a one bedroom house. She would wear her dresses and she would speak in a way that you know was very grand, and she would be very expressive and over the top with her mannerisms, and she's, you know, she was very well spoken. Even if they went out to dinner and places, she would keep up this persona that she was still part of that kind of upper echelon of lifestyle. And when the daughter began to show signs of schizophrenia at the age of 18, 19, she kind of took what her mother had taught her, and those built on the delusions and the delusions of grandeur that this poor young girl started experiencing when her schizophrenia kind of was triggered. So I would be caring for her. She was in her 80s at this point, and she spoke, she basically was the same as her mum from, you know, on the good day, on her clearer days, she would talk about her mum and her upbringing and what things were like. And then on other days, she would want you to put certain music on her iPad, and then she would say, don't speak to me, you're lower class, you're just scum. I'm going to be picked up from here tomorrow, and I'm going to be whisked away by this wealthy doctor, and he's going to take care of me. He's got a mansion on the shore. He lives on the coast, and he's going to take me to all these fancy dinners, and he's got a whole wardrobe full of beautiful dresses for me. And it was almost like her mother and her self, eventually, I suppose, because of the mother's influence, maybe, they couldn't handle not being part of that community, not being part of that lifestyle, and not having that life. And so she lived it. She just lived it in her own delusions. And that was the answer to it. She was like, well, if I can't physically have it, then, you know, then she basically, I mean, I haven't spoken to her for years, and I do think about her sometimes and hope that she's doing okay. But I just wonder if L. Ron Hubbard's done the same thing, if you know what I mean. It sounds like, I know that was a really long-winded way of me to say this.
No, I loved it.
But what I wanted to say is that it almost sounds as if he starts to have these psychological problems, psychiatric problems. He approaches somebody for help, and in that moment of approaching somebody for help, he's either decided that he doesn't need help because he has the answer, or help doesn't come quickly enough, and before he slips into what could be described as some type of mental health break. I said this in the last episode, like, I don't want to armchair diagnose, so I don't want to put any labels on it. But at the same time, who knows, maybe Dianetics has something to it. Maybe there's something in Dianetics that works. Maybe L. Ron Hubbard had some kind of epiphany, and he and the rest of Scientology have finally worked out something that the rest of us haven't. So who knows?
Well, I think it's the kind of thing that when you hear people talk about Scientology who have been inside of the religion, that they have, the foundations are things that they found useful. I think, because I don't think anybody would stay in it if they didn't gain something from it. I mean, a lot of the early courses are on things like, you know, managing healthy relationships, communicating when you have difficulties, money management, you know, things that we all would be attracted to come to. And just coming back to what you were saying about L. Ron Hubbard and your kind of story about the lady that you worked with, you know, these things, a lot of the things that L. Ron Hubbard writes about, you can see that he's got an interest of them because of where he came from. So the fact that he later has this inner circle of the Sea Organization, and his father's in the Navy and he's in the Navy, it's a very simplistic comparison, isn't it? But there is something to it. The things that he was attracted and interested in become the foundations, and the fact that he was suffering with difficulties is likely to have made him think, well, how can I address this? What can I look into? Which then becomes his point of writing Dianetics.
Mm-hmm.
Although it doesn't always go very well for him.
Right.
So he begins his Dianetics, and he's kind of lecturing at this point, and he's writing to a lot of psychology boards and reaching out and being like, okay, you know, I want people to hear about my new theories. And I read this story about him doing a lecture where he presented somebody who had gone clear and said that they would be able to tell the audience things that, you know, she had such brilliant intelligence that she would be able to just tell them all these things. So he says, right, okay, I'm going to turn around now, and I'm going to ask her, so what's the color of the tie that I was just wearing? And the woman gets it wrong, and half the audience left. So he definitely and I think there's like a number of different things that person wasn't able to recall.
Okay, so they hadn't rehearsed it, and it wasn't,
no, which I suppose.
So he genuinely had.
Well, you imagine with a lot of the people that are in these situations that their thought processes must be that this is genuinely the right thing. This is him you know, in earnest saying, hey, you know, I know this, I know that this works, and I want everyone else to see how well this works.
Mm-hmm.
That's his motivation behind it, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
So, he publishes Dianetics, okay? It's in October 30th, 1950. At this point, he kind of... it says that he resigns from the Navy, but obviously he wasn't active in service.
Whether
he was on kind of a with them, but retired. And Dianetics becomes a commercial success the second it's released. However, it receives a fair amount of criticism from newspapers, medical scientists and things. And so there's a lot that happens through these years. So I've just simplified it for anyone who's an L. Ron Hubbard expert. They'll probably be like, you've missed this spell. But the next kind of key thing happens is that in 1951, his wife, Sarah, files for a divorce. And she says that he was having multiple affairs and he was perpetrating horrendous domestic abuse towards her, which is centered around things like keeping her awake to the point where she's so sleep deprived that she feels suicidal because she just can't cope with this. And there becomes a custody battle between Sarah and Owen Hubbard's children. And later Sarah then says, you know, I didn't mean any of these things, and describes that he's a fine and brilliant man and she's able to keep custody of her children, and that kind of ends their marriage. So Hubbard now, on these philosophies, sets up the Hubbard College, and he marries a staff member called Mary Sue Whipp, which was only 18 years old at the time. So there's a fair age gap there. But really, really shortly after he sets up this college, he then, like a number of weeks later, moves to Phoenix, Arizona, where he starts the Church of Scientology. So that's where we begin. And the church spreads quite quickly. He ends up setting up, it becomes like what's described as a worldwide movement in 1960. So
nine years
from church opening to there being churches in the UK, there being churches in Canada. And it becomes something that's not just him.
Okay. Does it have to be like some sort of legal thing in place to call yourself a church? Or can you just call yourself a church?
So I think the kind of key thing around the church and the Scientology and giving themselves a church name is about the tax status,
because
the church is exempt from tax. So any profits that they would make on books or auditing or, you know, whatever people have given to the church wouldn't have to pay tax. And that comes into force in 1983. The church gets the status of tax exemptions. And
it's okay.
The church. Just a little while there. It continues to have that status today, as far as I'm aware. So, and I think that's one of the big controversies around Scientology, is because a lot of people kind of call Scientology out for being a money-making scheme.
I know there was a point in some of the brief research I did. Actually, I think it was in an episode of Last Podcast on the Left I listened to, speak about him in the usual tones that the men present their podcast in, if you've listened to Last Podcast on the Left. And they actually mentioned that they were given the tax-exempt status. Then L. Ron Hubbard was found to be dipping into the profits for his own personal expenditure. So they removed the tax-exempt status, and then L. Ron Hubbard became less active in the church and took a backseat role. And it was at that point that the church received its status back again.
Yeah. So he definitely, like, when I think we're leaping forward to like 1980s.
Yeah.
Is where he starts taking a step back.
Right. Okay.
Isn't as full on. So there was a lot of controversy from when it sets up as a worldwide organization in the 1960s,
right,
around Scientology and those things. So in 1963, there was a public inquiry launched in Virginia, Australia, and this then Scientology was banned in Western Australia, Western and Southern Australia, because it was described to be a self-improvement cult, and there were allegations that the church was brainwashing its parishioners. So that happens, and then there is a number of other, I mean, probably countless people being like, hey, I think we need to look into this new church that's starting up. It just doesn't, you know, those concerns around what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then Elron Hubbard then gets in, like, 1968, gets into kind of difficulty. And I've read lots of different views on what happens here.
Okay.
I think that he there was some concern around his kind of tax exemption, which is probably linked into what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of maybe embezzling the funds that the church was making. Anyway, he ends up starting in 1967 the Sea Organization.
Okay.
He moves into, because of all of this kind of bubbling difficulties in the communities, he sets up a fleet of ships, where there's a ship called the Apollo, and he called for his parishioners who wanted to commit themselves to the church to join him and be part of the Sea Organization.
Okay.
Kind of this, which everyone kind of calls the Sea Org everywhere. So this is, I think, what you're saying is everything's quite challenging. So, and by moving onto water, he's not basing himself in any land. So he can't be tried of crimes, he can't be investigated. And so while all of these kind of multiple different people are kind of rearing their heads and saying, hey, this isn't right, he's gone, well, it's me and my Sea Organization.
Okay, yeah.
Apollo. So Hubbard then takes a back seat, and he goes and kind of lives back in the US. And this is where David Miscavige, who is now, his official title escapes me, but he is the leader of the church. He's the figurehead of the church now, and he continues to be now today. And he kind of takes over after Hubbard, who is at this point really physically ill.
Okay.
Which is not something that Scientologists would agree with, because obviously if he was clear and he was producing all of this literature about Scientology, the fact that he had physical ailments was hid, because it would counteract all of his research that he'd put in, all of the philosophy, it would undermine it. So when L. Ron Hubbard finally passes, he has a stroke on January the 17th, 1986. The message for the church delivered by David Miscavige, and I'm sure anybody who's read anything about Scientology or seen anything will see this speech that David Miscavige gives, where he says that he drops his body. So they don't say that he's died of a stroke. They say he's dropped his body and he's gone to continue his research without the physical restraints of a body. And then David Miscavige becomes the leader.
Okay, so just explain that to us a little bit. What?
So the kind of basic principles of Scientology around this idea that you are a spiritual being and you're living through many multiple lives. You've had past lives, you'll have future lives, and that's kind of one of the basic philosophies. And when L. Ron Hubbard passes, the message given to the church is he's now continuing his research into Scientology in the ether, through being a spiritual being. He's reached that final, like, that standard that he no longer needs his body to sustain him.
Okay, so when I was in my teenage years, mm-hmm. when I was a big Twilight fan and read the books over and over, because I was the perfect age to be a victim to the Twilight saga. But then Stephanie Meyer released a book called The Host. And The Host was a book about these alien life forms, mm-hmm. that were like these little silvery centipede-y type things that would invade a planet and take over a host's form, mm-hmm. whether that was like a sea cucumber on a faraway watery planet in another galaxy far away.
Yeah.
Or Earth. So Earth gets invaded by these little silvery centipedey things that kind of attach themselves to the like base of the the brain stem. Yeah, and just basically they spend like a period of time on a planet, and they're very peaceful. They have very advanced medicines, and it is an interesting story. So when I read about Scientology, and I think the spirit forms are called other thetans.
Thetans, yeah.
So that's what I think of. I think of the host, and I think of these like little
silvery
centipede things that aren't bound to one planet. They can travel from one planet to another. And basically, so the main character of the story, she inhabits a body, but the consciousness is supposed to kind of take a back seat and go dormant. And then the, the form takes over the host's body, and the host is supposed to be completely dormant. But in some cases, the host's consciousness remains there. So the host is like, what are you doing invading my body? And the alien is like, well, we've come to nourish your planet, learn about your planet. We'll spend, a generation or two learning about your species, and then we'll move on to other planets and galaxies and stuff. So they're not there to like steal all the water or precious.
Not to harm, are they?
Yeah, no, they're just there to learn, basically. And then they go and they travel, so this alien life form thing has had like 12 lives and has lived on 12 different planets and experienced 12 different cycles of different existences. And that is almost what this makes. Well, that's what I think of when I think of Thetans. Yeah. So anybody that enjoyed the Twilight saga, go read The Host, because actually there's a film of it as well. And I enjoyed it when I was 14. So
I have not even heard of it. I think though that that's like the kind of foundations of this, is that a lot of people who are in Scientology, they genuinely, really wholeheartedly believe that Scientology is the way to cure not just themselves but also the whole of the world. Because if everybody believes in Scientology and follows the same principles, then we'll all be saved and we can all address that kind of like trauma that we've been through over the past however many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's my little history update. The rest of the kind of things is about the kind of principles of Scientology. This is the bit that just really fascinates me.
Okay, so I really enjoyed learning about L. Ron Hubbard. So thank you for the information. Do we know much about this David Miscavige guy?
Well, I haven't done like a backdrop of David Miscavige. I know that it's more that he was, this is like things that I've kind of heard and learned about it rather than kind of really looked into, but his dad was a Scientologist, and so mm-hmm. he joined the Sea Organization at a very young age. So I think he was kind of 15 and 16. His dad, Ron Hubbard, bought him the plane ticket to go to Clearwater, Florida, he could join the Sea Organization. And he went up the ranks of Scientology very, very quickly and becomes this kind of overwhelming presence in the church.
Right. And that's how Hubbard meets David Miscavige. Yeah.
So he's part of the Sea Organization. He's committed himself, and he's, David Miscavige, just from kind of observations, is a very charismatic leader. He's very, he And he obviously had a huge passion for the church to leave and at that age and go to be part of this organization and give that up. And he clearly had really big ambitions, and he's fulfilled them, hasn't he? He's made his way up the ranks.
Really. To the top, yeah.
Well, yeah, to the top. And he would, you know, the way that it would be framed is that L. Ron Hubbard is still the kind of leader, but he's passing messages to David Miscavige about where the future of the church is going.
It, yeah, that's interesting. It's almost like when I spoke to Dr. Janja Lalić, the cult expert who I interviewed a few episodes back. We spoke about some of the coverage on the Jehovah's Witnesses that I did. And even though Jehovah is the godhead of the religion of the church, there's still a group of 5 or 6 men who decide the direction the church is going to go in and what's published in the Watchtower and that sort of thing. So that feels quite similar in that way.
Yeah, so what I think the big difference between the two kind of leaders that you have in Scientology is that people who have left the inner circle, so the kind of C organization's kind of core, because I think there's layers to this. The C organization is probably quite broad and it becomes to the inner circle.
Okay.
And people who have left from the very, very inner circle would say that David Miscavige will say, I don't know what I'm gonna put out there next. I don't know what I'm gonna write. Because have you heard of The Bridge? The Bridge to Total Freedom. So this is kind of the like basis of the books, and you do the levels until you get to the point where you're clear, and then you have the operating theta levels, the OT levels. And they currently, I think, go up to level 8 at the moment. But what they're saying is that David Miscavige is writing and finding the next operating, the next OT levels coming from L. Ron Hubbard.
Right.
The inner circle will say that David Miscavige will turn and say, like, I don't know what to put out there. I don't know. We need to make this stuff up.
Right.
And there's a lot of kind of talk about the levels and the courses that you're doing, that you'll get to. So I think Leah Remini, who's spoken out so massively about Scientology and grew up as a Scientologist and then as a celebrity renounced anything to do with Scientology and is very actively against Scientology at the moment in her kind of podcast and her documentary, her series, she will say that you will start on a course and you will might make your way up to kind of a certain level of grade, and then the leaders of the church will go, oh wait, we actually made a mistake in 2 grades below you, so you'll have to go back, relearn all of that stuff.
And right,
so it's like I don't think you can ever kind of complete Scientology, because there will always be, even though there's a set structure and bridge, you will get up there and then you will have to go back and relearn different things, because they'll say that they found new meaning in the literature or they found different points that wasn't there previously.
I interrupt this episode to bring you a message from this week's awesome sponsor. It's a fellow podcast called Old Timey Crimey. Old Timey Crimey is a podcast that looks into historical true crime, cases of missing people, unsolved mysteries, crime and murder from back in the day. They have covered in-depth and fascinating cases from different points in history and cases from all over the world. The hosts, Scott, Christy and Amber, have a great rapport and chemistry that will keep you entertained and enthralled throughout their detailed episodes.
They even have episodes called Old Timey Crimey,
for those days where your commutes are shorter or your meals take less time to cook. I recently listened to the episode on the Somerton Man, which is one of my all-time favourite unsolved mysteries. It's about a man found deceased on the beach who ends up having a coded message sewn into the lining of his jeans. And to this day, nobody knows who he is. But the hosts covered this case in a way that I hadn't heard before. They have almost 100 episodes in their catalogue, so there's so much to keep you going throughout these winter months. It's a podcast that I highly recommend for any true crime fans. Old Timey Crimey can be found wherever you listen to your podcasts. So tune in today. That's Old Timey Crimey, where the good old days weren't always so good.
Right, okay. So why does he need to keep putting out these OT levels? Did L. Ron Hubbard promise that there was a certain level people could reach and he passed away before he'd written all the levels?
Not to my knowledge, but I suppose this comes back to like the motivation of the different leaders, in my view, that around what they could have been. So in the OT levels, you're meant to start getting certain powers. So they attach you to different things that you're now not just clear, but you're able to kind of, I mean, be invisible, for example.
Right.
You've done this certain course in Scientology. But I think it sounds like we've talked about it in the beginning of this, that L. Ron Hubbard genuinely believed the things that he was putting out. He was writing these literatures and wholeheartedly had them as a focus, whereas the message around David Miscavige is that maybe his intentions are slightly more on the more on the financial side.
Okay.
So I think we haven't touched on this, but the cost of being in Scientology, being part of that church, is very it's extortionate. That we start off with these courses that are small, and then we get the cost to engage in these different things is huge. And I tried to look for different figures around what they estimate it would take for you to become OT8.
Right.
And the figures are just so wildly different. So I wasn't able to kind of like get a clear figure on that, but you know that people are spending huge amounts of money to do these courses. Their life savings are going into these, you know, your house, you'll remortgage your house because it gives you the money that enables you to reach the literature, to reach a certain level. And on top of that, there's a lot of parishioners that have left Scientology who talk about how they weren't just asked to buy their own copies, but they would have to buy copies to donate to libraries. And then because the courses were kind of reinvented or new things were learned, you would then have to buy all of the materials that went for another course over again at huge expense.
Right. So from what you've said there, I'm gathering that to move up these levels, you have to gain access to literature, read that literature, and through that literature, that's how you gain that next step and those powers.
But not just read and gain.
Right.
So I think L. Ron Hubbard is very, had a huge focus on understanding the meaning of the words. And this is something that's in the Beyond Belief book as well. And described by, there's a very short video of L. Ron Hubbard while he's on the ship of Apollo, and he talks about a word, and then he reenacts the definition of the word. So to understand a text, you would need to learn what a word meant, so what the definition of the word "and" meant in all of its different contexts. And by understanding not just the word, but like is it etymology of the word,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You understand what it means in all of those different contexts, you would then be able to understand the literature all over together.
Okay, but if you're reading a book with like a million words and you have to, that's wild. That's
yeah.
So the word "so," for example, I would have to research that and understand it in all its different contexts and where it originated from.
Yeah. And so what they would say is, if you don't understand the text, if you don't know what that means, it's because you haven't understood a word. It's not that if you question someone.
Oh, okay.
Go back, look, you must not know the definitions of your words, right? So you need to go back. You need to learn that again.
Okay, so it's a little bit like, if I'm going to compare it to something else I've looked into before, it's a little bit like if you're feeling like your faith is dwindling in something like ISKCON with the Hare Krishnas, for example, you will be told to chant more. And if that feeling doesn't go away, if your doubts don't go away, it's because you're not chanting enough. So you're recommended to continue chanting. So if you read one of these books and you don't gain these powers, or you don't feel like you've reached the next level of whatever it is they've promised you, it's because of something you've done or something you don't understand.
So that's like an overwhelming message from people that have left the church, is that they're saying that they felt like everything was their fault. So it wasn't that you didn't question David Miscavige, you didn't question Elwyn Hubbard, you didn't question the text, you didn't question, and we haven't talked about auditing, but it's a huge part of it. You know, you didn't question your auditor. You were, everything came back as you not fully understanding things.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned there Beyond Belief, which is a book, and I know that we mentioned it before we hit record, but just give everybody a little bit of context about the book itself. I've actually got it right here. I got it as a Christmas present.
Really interesting book. So is it written by, now this is Tessica Wendell, is it Jenna Miscavige Hall?
Hill,
so close. So she is David Miscavige's niece, and she grows up within the church, and she kind of gives an account of what it is like to be somebody who grows up within Scientology, that becomes a member of the Sea organization, and then questions the church and makes the decision eventually to leave, and now publicly speaks out about her experiences of leaving the church.
So let me just, there's something I was reading about David Miscavige. So this was his niece that published this book, Beyond Belief, and she speaks out quite extensively in the book about Scientology. So David Miscavige's wife, Shelley Miscavige, she was last seen in public in 2007.
Yes.
So it's my understanding that David Miscavige's father, who was once an extremely devout Scientologist, actually himself has renounced the faith and speaks out publicly also, and speaks about what he thinks may have happened to his daughter-in-law. And because she began to speak out about Scientology herself, all of a sudden kind of just disappeared. So there's all these conspiracy theories around what has happened to Shelley Miscavige and why she hasn't been seen for so long. Some people think that, you know, that maybe she's been killed and taken somewhere. David Miscavige's father thinks that she's being detained and held somewhere and will probably never hear or see her again. So it's interesting that so many family members around David Miscavige have renounced their faith and speak out against the church. But and as soon as his wife seemed to be doing the same thing, just suddenly vanishes, and nobody really knows where she is, what's happened to her. So that's interesting. It's definitely something I want to cover on a conspiracy episode at some point.
So Leah Remini and files a missing persons report, and the police go to Clearwater to try and find her, and they claim that they have seen her, the police, more recently than, was it 2007? However, that was like, there is a big question mark over where she is and what's happened there.
Especially with the growing sort of influence that Scientology has in different areas of society in terms of law and government and things like that. You know, there's increasingly more influential people joining the Church of Scientology, that there is almost, you know, people could say that the police could have been paid off, or the police have ties to Scientology. So, you know, if there's no physical evidence that she has been seen, then maybe that's not the truth. I don't know. It's just interesting. And it is a bit of a rabbit hole. And it is one of those things that I've read up about and thought, oh, I really do want to talk about this. So maybe, yeah, maybe that's something to think about in the weeks to come. But yeah, as a side note, as you mentioned, Jenna Miscavige Hill's book Beyond Belief, where she speaks about her journey through Scientology and her exit from Scientology, and David Miscavige's father and wife, I just thought it'd be interesting to kind of let the listeners know that there is that little aside that's going on with Scientology.
Definitely. And that's something so interesting, because it feels to me like there are layers within Scientology, and Jenna Miscavige Hill talks about this in her book, that she is sent to go and set up a Scientology church, I think in Australia, and she goes and finds that people are just, you know, normal, regular people who are part of Scientology and not in this level of extremism that we see in the C organization and kind of the inner circle. So it's almost as if you could be a practitioner of Scientology, you could be a member of Scientology church where you live, and you can buy the books and you can do the self-study that you need to do and be part of the church, and and be a person that maybe this doesn't take over your life in the same way that we see when people are in that kind of real inner circle of the church.
Yeah, where they live and breathe Scientology every single day. Because I know that members of the Sea Org dedicate their lives to Scientology.
Not their life. They sign a 1 billion year contract. Because they're thetans, so they're going to be reborn into the next body, and so they're not just signing up for that life, they're signing up for loads of lives. So let's do this, let's get into the Sea Org, because that's just
okay.
This just fascinates me, and this principle as well about the we've talked about it before the podcast started, but the children are not children, they are spiritual beings in small bodies, so, and they're treated as such. So you would ask for a six-year-old would be expected to do exactly the same level of work and same level of understanding as a 50-year-old, because they're just as much of a thetan as the next person. And this principle also breaks down family ties, so members of the kind of church who are dedicating their lives to the church will your might have a mother, but it's not your mother. It's not an emotional thing that it's your mother, because it's just your mother in this life, and it's just your father in this life, and your brother in this life. So there's not the same importance on family ties, which means that the overall focus is on the church and being part of the religion, being part of that.
Right.
Your dedication is towards the goal of Scientology and not to your family around you.
So let me just try and get my thoughts around this. So if I sign a 1 billion year contract, mm-hmm. so that me as a thetan, not my body as a shell or as a vessel or whatever. So when I'm reborn, how come I don't know? I'm 27 now. Surely I should know that I've signed this contract and make my way back to Scientology.
That's an interesting point. So I suppose maybe you would be reborn into the Sea organization.
Yeah, because you're supposed to commit your life to the Sea Org, then you die, then you go back to the Sea Org. Then you get a new vessel.
Yeah.
You shed your old vessel and you get a new vessel, and then you go back to the Sea Org and you commit another lifetime to the Sea Org, and then you shed your vessel again, and then you get a new one, and then you're supposed to do that for a billion years. You're supposed to.
Yeah. So that's your contract, is for a billion years. But here's the kind of interesting part about, so the Sea organization, I think, have reviewed their rules, and so I think you have to be 12, but I'm not 100% sure on that you have to before you can join the Sea organization, because they don't want children in the Sea Org, and they also don't allow pregnancy in the Sea Org.
But you're still a child if you're 12. You're still
But you're tiny. Thetan, you're a spiritual being.
Yeah. So
yeah. It must be something about that. So the joining the Sea Org means you're going to get accommodation and you're going to get food. You're going to get some money. So very, very small amounts of money that you can to be part of this organization. And then, which is part of what people describe becomes this entrapment and this kind of level of where people say it's like a cult, in that you are unable to leave because you don't have access to those kind of really basic resources. You're living in a place where everything is paid for by the church.
Okay, so are we living in like dorm styled living? Do we have our own rooms? Yeah. Is it like a hotel? And the Sea Org at this point is not on the sea anymore. It's mostly on land.
Yeah. So there's flagship flag, which is in Clearwater, which is the headquarters.
And that's on land.
Yeah. But there's also like the celebrity center. There's also going to be bases all around the world. And like, as Jenna talks about in her book, is that she goes from being in, I don't think she was at Flag, I think she was somewhere else, and she is then goes to Australia to set up a church. So she is like out in these outreach missions to try and,
so that's her role in the Sea Org, is to,
yeah,
okay, so that's the type of thing you would be expected to do if you joined the Sea Org and signed a billion year contract.
Yeah, but I think it's really varied, because I think it's a whole community of people in the Sea Org. So there's going to be some people who are going to be cooks that are preparing food. There are going to be some people who are going to be part of the marketing team. They're going to be part of the event coordination. They're going to work in the celebrity
sector. Okay. That's interesting. So the principles of the Navy and the teachings that Hubbard gained from the Navy have stayed within the Sea Org in terms of living boot camp style, in shared dorms and having strict exercise regimes, and restricted access to food and luxuries and money and that sort of thing. So yeah,
it becomes everything for you, this commitment.
It becomes,
you're all in. All of your resources are gone. You are part of the church and you are in the role that you are assigned to be in.
Well, how long does that last for then? How long are you expected to live in this dorm-styled life before you are given a role in the Sea Org to go off and carry out?
I think it's just so, it's, from my understanding, is it's so varied that you could be based in somewhere where you were in a kind of dormitory type setup. You could also, and your parents could be in a different part of the organization. They could be doing completely different roles. They could be part of different teams running different projects.
Okay.
And would have different kind of setups. But it's very, very common, I think, if you're a family that are born into the Sea organization, I need to be clear about this. There is a lot of people who have left the church who were in the Sea organization who have said that they weren't able to have children being within the Sea Org. So the decision, there is a lot of allegations of forced miscarriages, forced abortions from being in the Sea Org.
And why is that? Is it just like not wanting
to lose
valuable labor to parenting, or,
you know, I think that's just open for interpretation on the rules.
Yeah,
people have said that they wanted to start a family. They've married a Scientologist that they met through the Sea Org, and then they've wanted to start a family and they've taken a step back. They've left the Sea organization and had children, which is an interesting thing that is something that happens, given that they've signed a 1 billion year contract. But you also can imagine that a church would want people who have grown up within Scientology. This is the way that a lot of people learn about the church and they become part of it, is because of their family ties. So maybe by not directly being in the Sea Org, but taking a step back and being part of the community of Scientologists, that will enable the church to be further on. And a lot of people who've left will talk about how they're, you know, they worked in a car company, but the owner was a Scientologist. Everyone that worked there was a Scientologist. They rented their house from a Scientologist. So the same ties were there. Mm-hmm. The community that we're in were holding them up, really.
Interesting. So the Sea Org itself sounds quite militarized. Do they have a uniform?
Yeah, so it's very okay. Similar, like navy uniform, like navy, not navy, the color navy, the like the army kind of uniform that people would wear and kind of be a symbol. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it sounds like the Sea Org is you could be somebody who, take Christianity for example, you could be somebody who says grace before dinner and maybe says a prayer before bed and goes, or even just goes to Sunday service, or even just goes to a Christmas Eve service. Mm-hmm. Not an avid church goer, doesn't religiously read the Bible, isn't involved in every single church activity, isn't spending 1, 2, 3, 4 hours a day on church activities, and it's just kind of, you know, still spiritual, still practicing, still living life by the guidelines of the religion, but not devoting every single day or lots of significant free time to their religion. So that could just be like the Scientologists who become part of the church. They purchase 1 or 2 pieces of literature. That's enough for them. They have enough to go by those principles. They have the Book of Dianetics. They kind of live by those principles. You know, they practice that spiritually, and carry out, you know, the guidelines of that book without investing in all of these courses and OT levels, and joining the Sea Org, which is then where you would be devoting every single day of your life with no free time, living and breathing your religion with kind of no time to take a step back and breathe almost.
Yeah, I think Leah Remini would say that people at the kind of lower end of the Scientology church, they're still dedicating 2.5 hours minimum a day to their study.
Oh my goodness.
They're still on the path to courses and they're still being encouraged to do that.
Right.
No, I don't think there's necessarily a kind of casual user, like a casual Scientology member. I think it's still, if you're, I mean, it must be a gradual thing, mustn't it? Because you can't imagine that people, there's got to be that initial attraction, which we talked about earlier, that mm-hmm. relate to people, and then the it has to be useful and enough that it enables people to want to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Becomes part of that way of life. But we definitely see these kind of cult principles played out much heavier towards the Sea Organization scale of Scientology.
Yeah.
And what we haven't kind of talked about is the kind of people, particularly Mike Rinder, who was a very senior member of the Scientology Church, who is now works with Leah Remini and gone public about how his experiences within the church. And he describes being in this very close inner circle with David Miscavige, and he was in Flag in Clearwater, and he describes being in this place called The Hole, which is all of the kind of officers and officials being locked in one room together, being given slops to eat, being forced to beat each other until they've confessed their crimes.
Right, okay. And
this is something we haven't talked about as well, is that in Scientology, it's very, the kind of very, very common for people to submit something called a knowledge report.
Yeah, yeah.
On a their brother or their partner or somebody who they see to be questioning the church or to be kind of
right, yeah.
Or and it could be something as simple as making a comment about, you know, another person, and that you could be written up, and there would be an internal report sent through, and then we see a process of people coming in for auditing sessions, which they're paying for, where people are holding on to the e-meter.
Yeah, so we haven't gone through auditing, so
no, we haven't.
So just finish up it explaining about the knowledge reports and the consequences of being written up, and then we'll snap back to auditing. If anybody that's listening is like, we keep saying auditing and we haven't told you what it is.
Yeah, so I think it's just a way of keeping people in check, isn't it, these knowledge reports, because you would be afraid that if you question the church and you made any comments that were negative about the church, mm-hmm. that the people around you and that you love would write up a report, and then there would be consequences for the fact that you've done that.
Yeah. And that's very common. We've talked about that with the troubled teen industry, how reporting culture is such a big thing. And we've talked about that with the Jehovah's Witnesses, how it's expected that you will go and snitch almost if you have noticed somebody doing something. Even in the Pentecostal episodes I've just released, one girl got into trouble because she trimmed the ends of her hair, and she'd signed a contract at where a young of 14, I think she was. She'd signed a contract to say she wouldn't cut her hair because you're supposed to be, you know, modest on the outside. And she got told off because she got snitched on for trimming the ends of her hair. So a lot of these movements that we can apply cult-like methods of control to, that we can go through something like Stephen Hassan's bite model and apply different types of control that groups may have or use on the members, keeping people in fear of one another stops them from being in fear of those in positions of power. And it's the same in the prison systems. I wrote about this in my dissertation. You know, in American prisons, mostly from the research I did, the prison guards will segregate different nationalities and different people from different ethnical backgrounds. And they say the Hispanics will be in this corner, the people of color will be in this corner, the Asians will be in this corner, you know, and the Caucasian Americans will be in this corner. And then it's almost like if an Asian person crosses over to the Caucasian side of the prison camp, mm-hmm. then all hell breaks loose, and the prisoners are kind of keeping themselves in check, and they're so scared of each other, and they're so scared of crossing over into the wrong territories, that they're not really looking at the types of abuse that could be inflicted on them by people in positions of power, like the prison guards, for example. So I'm not saying that every single American prison uses this system and every single prison guard is trying to abuse the prisoners, but there have been documentaries where this has been seen to have happened, and prison guards have told the people making the documentaries that is what they are doing.
Yeah. It's an observation Louis Theroux makes in his World Toughest Prisons. You know, he talks about how everybody's so segregated, and he interviews people there, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this does, this kind of method of, it creates a culture of fear.
Yeah. You
don't trust anybody.
Exactly.
And that stops people questioning.
And forming relationships.
Yeah, because you and your devotion is ultimately to the church, to the that figure, because you can't, there's nothing, you can't form that relationship with your partner, because your partner could write up a comment that you make,
mm-hmm. and if they don't, and later on it comes out anyway from somewhere else or some other way, then there's a chance that the person that had knowledge of it and didn't bring it to the attention of somebody in a position of power or an authority figure, then themselves risk getting into more trouble or facing severe consequences or more severe consequences.
Yeah.
Because they withheld the information, and obviously it's encouraged that you would bring that information to the attention of somebody who can dish out whatever punishment they deem.
Mm-hmm. The consequences for what's happened, completely.
So that's knowledge. That's knowledge reports. And is that a big thing, like in the Sea Org, or just across Scientology in general?
I think it's across Scientology in general.
Okay,
but it is definitely a big thing in the Sea Org, because that is one way that people are keeping you in check.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to auditing. What is it?
So auditing is a process where you will go into a room with somebody who is a Scientology member that is a trained auditor. And it's something, as you move up the ranks, you might yourself learn how to be an auditor. And it's a machine that you hold on to called an e-meter, which is a lie detector. And you will hold the two kind of metal, what's it called, like, you know, parts of the instrument. And I think it seems very similar to kind of counseling to begin with, that there is it engrams, the things that the traumas that you've had in your life, you will speak about, and they will be recorded. And the concept is that you will repeat that information over and over again at great expense to yourself, and also being recorded by the church to the point where you don't have the same reactions. And I think that's when you clear the memory, because you've repeated it to the point where it's no longer causing you distress, it's no longer challenging.
And okay,
to move on.
Okay, I could see how that would be beneficial for somebody. Completely. I mean, do you know how much, I'm guessing you have to pay for an auditing session.
Yeah, I don't know the exact figure for an auditing session, and I would anticipate that it probably is varied.
Is it something that Scientologists do repeatedly, or is it sort of like an initiation thing, or?
Yeah, so you get like package deals on them. So you buy, you could buy 100 hours of auditing cost from 50 hours, and then you would engage in that as part of your courses and your study.
Right, okay. So obviously you go in, well, I don't know if it is obvious, but you go into your auditing session, mm-hmm. with your auditor, who I'm guessing has been trained, mm-hmm. by people who have been trained by L. Ron Hubbard's literature on how to carry out these things. And so you go to your auditing session, and if you wanted to talk about something that caused you great stress, like, I don't know, sometimes I think about, I sprained my ankle really badly once, and sometimes when I can't sleep, the noise it made when it popped, sometimes I just end up replaying that in my head, because it's like, you know, really strange things you think about when you can't sleep. And then I think about when I sprained my ankle, mm-hmm. and the pop, and I replay it over and over. So let's say I go into my auditing session and I really don't want to think about this sprained ankle anymore. So part of my 100 hours would be spent on clearing that engram.
Yeah.
So I guess that's down to the auditor how long that takes. Will they tell me when my reactions have changed?
Yeah. And you also are not just addressing the ankle you break in this life, you're addressing the ankle you break three lives ago, because you carry those engrams.
So they could tell me that I had like a really bad car crash three lives ago, but I've carried it with me into this life. And so I might never be clear then. There could be things, I don't know, that happened to me in my past lives that are affecting me today that I can't remember or recall.
Yeah, but the concept is if you're working with Scientology, you will it's not that they will tell you that you've had a car crash, it's that you will tell them.
So I could say I feel like I may have had a car crash, although not in this life.
Yeah. And sometimes they might be kind of things that you've done that aren't very wrong, aren't good, you know, things you're ashamed of, things that have broken the law, and recalling those in that environment is very dangerous, isn't it? Because if somebody is recording.
Yeah. And I suppose they're the types of environments where you would speak about those things, especially if you really want to reach that level that L. Ron Hubbard promises you could reach by going through this auditing process. But what if it takes me 100 hours for the auditor to tell me that I've finally become clear on the engram around my ankle?
That's how long it takes. So you just need to buy another bundle. You need to do more auditing sessions. You need to just get back to it.
That feels that feels a little bit unjustified.
Yeah.
That I have to wait for somebody else to tell me that I am reacting differently to it based on what the e-meter is saying, and not my physical reaction to it and how it makes me feel.
Yeah, completely. And something we kind of talked about it in the knowledge report bit is that people will submit a knowledge report, and then you might be called in for something like called a security check, which is where they're using the e-meter and this auditing process, but you're not talking, you're being asked to confess to what you've done wrong, what crime you've committed.
Right. And that could be anything. That could be the bottle of vodka that I drank last week.
Yeah. It could be the comment you made about the latest bit of literature not making sense to you.
And you could admit to all these things, hoping that you mention the one thing that they're talking about, incriminating yourself the whole time and potentially getting yourself into more trouble.
Definitely. And so this is, and I know that we've jumped a bit, but we were talking about the whole, that kind of inner circle.
Where yes.
That David Miscavige was saying, I'm leaving you in this room, in the hole, until you confess to your crimes. And that's why things are going wrong, is because one of you is committing crimes. And what Mike Rinder talks about is this essential process of people beating one another until somebody confesses a crime. So we then see this very kind of more sinister side of the church in that is that there are these multiple allegations of David Miscavige being, you know, physically attacking people within his organization. Mm-hmm. And kind of Leah Remini puts this really, really well about how it's the idea of, it's like somebody saying that the Pope has beaten people up. Like, the concept of it is so alien because he is the all-powerful leader. He's the figurehead of this.
Okay. But didn't you mention briefly something about L. Ron Hubbard and allegations that his wife insinuated against him?
Yeah. There was allegations that his wife, Sarah, had he physically abused her. And yet we're kind of seeing that same allegations against David Miscavige. But the concept is that you have been told over and over again that you must have done something wrong. So being attacked by David Miscavige wouldn't be, the automatic response wouldn't necessarily be like, hey, this guy is physically attacking me and this is wrong. It'd be like, well, I deserve this. I did something wrong. Mm-hmm. I must have committed a crime. I must have
done this wrong. It sounds extremely similar to Synanon and the tactics used in the therapeutic boarding schools across the troubled teen industry, where a lot of the young people recall having somebody scream so much in their face, telling them to admit to things they'd done, that they would end up making things up just to stop the screaming, just to stop the shouting, and to, just to end the session that they were in. They would end up admitting to something that, you know, admitting to, I don't know, having sex at the age of 13 when they didn't even know what sex was, you know, and things like that.
That's a massive theme, isn't it? So that people would confess to crimes that they hadn't necessarily done. But also when we were talking earlier about reading the textbooks and saying that you could say that you understood it, that it all made sense to you when you read these things, even if it didn't, because that would mean that you could move on to the next level.
Yep. And it's that's similar to Pentecostals, when they all say that they can speak in tongues, but all the ex-members I've spoken to said that they were speaking gibberish in the hopes that people wouldn't realize that they were pretending. And the whole while they did that, they were thinking, oh, it'll come to me one day I really will speak in tongues, and it just never happened.
Yeah, faking it till you make it.
Yeah.
So there's one big part of Scientology that we've kind of not talked about, and I'm sure there's other things that people haven't talked about, but it's the process of leaving the
church. Okay.
So if you say you've committed crimes, you've been found to have committed loads and loads of crimes and had allegations, you could be declared as a suppressive person.
Right. And then
ostracized from the church. So that could be if you were had done something wrong, or if you decided to leave. And one way that Scientology kind of keeps people from learning that the view of Scientology is not necessarily positive is that if somebody in your family or somebody you know is declared a suppressive person, then you need to disconnect from them. So that would end all of your relationships.
Okay.
And there are examples of this, that people will be told that their dad is about to be declared before their dad knows, and they need to make the decision. Are you going to disconnect, or are you going to be declared as well?
Oh, that's...
And the decisions are like right here, right now. You need to tell me what you're going to do. And so when all of these public figures, like Mike Rinder, like Leah Remini, like anybody who's left the church, the Scientologists, they no longer say that this policy exists, but they had this fair game policy where basically they would, if somebody left the church and then publicly spoke out about their experiences of it, then they would be fair game. And the church denies this now. They say that this doesn't happen and it's not a policy, even though there's been shows that have shown the literature of like the fair game policy. And so then we see people being very publicly targeted. So things like Mike Rinder will talk about constantly being followed by by private investigators. They will find that their car has been bugged, that their home has been bugged, that people have paid the bin men to steal their trash and give it to them so it can be examined for evidence against them. And like Leah Remini talks about how she will, you know, if she's anytime she is doing anything, there will be people who will target the kind of advertisers for her things, that any company that she's working with, that will write to them and make allegations about her to try and discredit what she's doing about Scientology and try and discredit.
Right. So that's quite scary, isn't it? Especially because of the financial, like the financial giant that Scientology is, that the Church of Scientology is, the billions and billions that they have. I know that they have very extensive legal teams that will sift through the internet and defend the church against people that speak out. So I've had a few people actually reach out on Reddit and tell me to get legal advice before covering Scientology, just because of the potential backlash that I could get personally from using this platform to speak to ex-members of Scientology. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if there will be any backlash. I don't know if people will start contacting me or attempting to communicate with me. It's only a very small platform, and there are other podcasts out there that are much bigger than mine that have spoken egregiously about Scientology. So I think it's going to be okay. But
yeah, and also this is information that has been shared by people who have left mm-hmm. the church, and like neither me and Casey have a personal experience of this, isn't it?
You know, yeah.
Much. And I'm sure if you wanted to learn more about Scientology as a religion, you can find that information on their website, on their, you know,
in these books that people have published.
By accessing the courses, if you wanted to see it from a different view. But mm-hmm. it's very interesting that the overwhelming picture around Scientology is that it's a very interesting organization, and the kind of philosophies and practices are quite different from a lot of religions that we see, which are rooted mm-hmm. in Christianity or Judaism or whatever. You know, they've developed these things one step further, whereas Scientology is kind of like a whole new branch. And I think what I find amazing about Scientology is that there will be a church near you. There will be an organization that is in around the corner. I know that when I lived in Birmingham, they opened up a huge Scientology church, and it's amazing seeing that this thing that's so kind of widely regarded as a cult being so prevalent.
Yeah, it is, especially because the headquarters now, I believe, is in LA. Even if that wasn't the original birthplace of the Church of Scientology, the big, ornate, beautiful building is in LA. Mm-hmm. And
Celebrity Center.
Yeah, so you think, when you think of Scientology, you think of Los Angeles, and you think of these iconic celebrities who have spoken about their involvement and in the church and their beliefs around you know, Dianetics and the church itself, and moving up the levels themselves and paying to access these next levels of literature. And you think of America, and you don't think of there being Scientology centers around the corner from where we are in little England, but they are here. And there's been a lot of cases. The Louis Theroux episode I watched, where the woman was, have you seen it? Was she a member of the Sea? Yeah, was she a member of the Sea Org when he was by his car, and she was shouting at him about having the right permits, or
because the road he was on was a private road.
That was it.
A private road, and they needed to get off the property. Yeah,
but he had the permission letter with him.
Yeah, I think he goes twice, doesn't he? And then, so yeah, it's
and then he speaks about having his emails hacked and passwords changed on his devices, and he'd visited a particular center in a particular area of America, and when he found out the place, the IP address that had hacked his devices, it turned out to be exactly that place that he had just visited, that location that he had just been in, to speak to members of Scientology. So it is a bit worrying, the influence and power that this religion seems to have. And I guess that's where a lot of the negative publicity comes from. The very aggressive tactics that Scientology have used to disassociate themselves from any negative press. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I'll sum that up. Yeah.
Great summing. That's my Scientology. That's what I know, or I think I know.
Well, you said that you didn't know much, and you've come here and you've told me everything. So,
well,
I think you've done a splendid job.
Thank you so much.
If there is anything that we've missed out, I'm sure that the interviews that I have, been lucky to do,
that are just maybe not as accurate as they could be, but I'm sure that if people can tell them us about them.
If there's anything that we've said wrong, or anything you can clarify for us, Yeah, I would love to know. It's also interesting to go on the X Scientology subreddit and to read some of the stories and accounts on there. So if you're a member of Scientology and you would like to connect, or even an ex-member and you'd like to connect with other ex-members, then there is the X Scientology subreddit. No idea if that is monitored by any practicing Scientologists or anything like that. I should imagine it is, probably. So yeah, I think it's been a productive interview. So thank you so much, Lou, for coming and joining me today. We'll have you back for a new topic in a few months' time.
So welcome. It was great to be here.
And thank you so much, Lou. I enjoy your dinner and I will speak to you soon.
Okay, love you, bye.
Love you, bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. A massive thank you to Lou for all of her hard work and research for this episode. We will include the sources in our episode description. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by emailing me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or find me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I am your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.